This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When William Travis Kukovich fell from a pickup truck as a boy, it changed the trajectory of his life. Now, teachers labeled him with a learning disability, but that did not stop him from becoming an award-winning jeweler. In fact, it may have helped. He was diagnosed with breast cancer in his mid-20s and not only survived but developed a philosophy that has helped propel him forward, a philosophy of saying yes. Despite being told no repeatedly, he launched his first store in Chapel Hill in 2002, and his reputation has traveled around the world. In fact, some big stars like Usher and Whoopi Goldberg sport his jewelry. He has run the store, William Travis Jewelry, in Chapel Hill for 16 years and joins us now. Travis, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thank you. What an honor to be on the show.
Great to have you here. I want to talk about that accident on the truck, but first, how your family came to be in Kansas in the first place.
Sure. So my family immigrated here in the early 40s. We don't know a whole lot. They were very adamant about hiding their background. They were Polish Jews and spoke German. I remember as a child my grandmother saying to me, when I spoke to her about this, why we couldn't speak German in the house or anything like that, she said, well, we're two of the three worst things to be in the United States. We are German-speaking Jews. And it was really something that that we hid. And you didn't really want anyone to know. My family really wanted to assimilate at that time in history. And I think most people who have similar backgrounds would tell you the same thing, that their families really wanted to just assimilate and become American.
Yeah, but it also points to the fact that immigration has always been, I mean, we like to think of ourselves with open arms. We've really never had open arms.
No, that's absolutely
never
true.
I mean, that's part of being American, sadly enough,
yes,
is turning our backs on immigrants who then, after they make it, however they do it, if they're not systematically discriminated against and kept from building wealth, then there's a glory story that gets layered on top of that.
Sure.
So assimilated how? What were they doing? What were they doing?
Metalsmiths. So I'm a fifth generation metalsmith. They brought over a suitcase full of hammers and a suitcase full of pictures, and that's about all they brought with them. They came in through New Orleans and had relatives, distant relatives in the Kansas City area, went up there and then traveled down to southeast Kansas, around Pittsburgh, Kansas, Joplin, Missouri, this part of the world. And there was a coal mining industry going on there. It's one of the few places in the United States that has anthracite coal, which is the black, the really dark black stuff that you think of as in putting in your stocking if you're bad. So, and they were metalsmiths down there and kept doing that. And after to support the war effort. And after that, they went on to do other metalsmithing. My brother has an ornamental iron company in the Midwest, and almost everyone in my family is a metalsmith. I went smaller. I got more and more detailed, which probably, that's probably the portion that connects to the head injury more than anything, is the size and scale that I went down to.
Well, talk about that. You were 4 years old, right?
I was 4 years old, and my mother, a great woman, allowed us to ride in the back of the truck, and we were coming home from taking some trash to the trash dump, and we had a number 9 wash tub, if you know what that is, and I turned it upside down and stood up at the cab of the truck and was directing my older brother while he sang like a rhinestone cowboy. And she was going about 60, 65 miles an hour down a paved road. Actually, they were not even paved back then. It was old 69 highway. It was poured concrete slabs. And I just went, hit a bump, and I went flying right out the back. And really bad, life-threatening injuries. The whole left side of my skull was pretty much crashed in. The scars are still very visible today. And it was after that that my family, mainly my mother, started noticing major changes in me.
What kind of changes?
Well, I was getting ready to go into kindergarten, so she had been working with me on ABCs and counting to 100, and these type of things. And when we took it up again, when I got well, they thought I was going to die. I heard that word mentioned a lot while I was in the hospital. My father, who had my parents got divorced when I was 4 months old, and my father was living in Australia, came back because they truly thought I was going to die. And when she started working with me again on my ABCs and counting and all this, she thought maybe I had just lost it because I'd been in the hospital for, you know, a few months and these type of things. But it wasn't that. And she quickly realized that. And then it turned into diagnosing me with lots of different learning disabilities. But even though this wasn't so long ago, we've come a long ways. Words like dyslexia weren't even heard of then. And so they thought I was that, and they thought lots of different things. And eventually we sort of discovered that this was very different than that. For example, I can barely read at all. And I can't spell. I don't write words. I draw words. That's the best way I can describe it.
Would this be like imitating the shapes?
That's exactly right.
Not really hearing the sounds.
That's
or associating
exactly right.
With it.
Yes, I draw words, and it makes my handwriting change from day to day. Yeah. If you've ever painted or done any kind of artwork, sometimes you're better than others. So some days my handwriting looks okay, and sometimes it doesn't. I've formed a way of kind of scribbling my name in a pattern so that I have a signature that is always my signature. But
but what about reading, and how did you get through school?
That's really hard. My mother read everything to me, and I spent most of my life I spent in most of my education I spent in remedial classes. And they didn't have, you know, it was tough. Southeast Kansas, I was the largest graduating, my class was the largest graduating class from my high school in Girard, Kansas ever. And it was 100 people. So I spent half of my day away from my peers and friends in these remedial classes. And you were in there with everybody. There was no segregating us.
And they
didn't
have reading disabilities over here.
That's right.
The other
you're
kinds
just in
of
there
emotional. Everybody
yeah.
was all together. Yeah. And you were one of seven children in that
That's
family.
That's correct.
And your family didn't have a lot of money.
Oh, God, no. We were very, very poor. As I mentioned earlier, my father left when I was 4 months old, and my mother had other children. And we were very, very poor. I'm sure you have listeners out there who remember government cheese, and I can tell you that we were happy to get government cheese. We were thrilled. We couldn't believe it. Cheese sandwiches, cheese toast, tomatoes and cheese. I mean, I feel like Forrest Gump with the shrimp on the government cheese, but let me tell you, I love that cheese.
What was your sense of what you were going to do? Were you, because you had other male influences? A lot of your extended family was in that part of Kansas, right?
I did, with all of my relatives, being a fifth generation metalsmith, once the learning disability was found, which was very early, I worked with them all the time. I mean, I started hammering when I was just a kid. And I started really working. I think I was really good at 12.
And it wasn't jewelry. They were doing all kinds of metalwork, right?
So I was doing small items for gates and doors and things like that. I remember, I think they were just trying to get rid of me, to be honest. And they would give me some copper and brass and say, go make a dragonfly. And then I would come back with this thing. And they're like, oh, well, that's pretty good. Why don't you go make three or four more of those? And to their credit, they realized that I was doing this on a smaller level, and really pushed me to do that. Of course, we couldn't afford gold or silver or platinum or anything like that, but they really encouraged me to work on a macro level on a very, very small scale. And even got me some magnification, some optivizers when I was a child to help me out with that. And they, although we were poor, they were just happy and you know, so much fun. I just couldn't wait to go to the shop. You know, when I got out of school, I just wanted to be around them, and I put on the same overalls, and, you know, we'd get out there, and I just loved it. I just loved it.
So did you imagine yourself this was going to be it then? This
would be your did. Life? I did. I've known what I was going to do since I was 12 years old. I've always known. I didn't realize how lucky I was until I got into my mid-30s, and a lot of my friends started quitting their jobs and going back to school or starting new careers. And I said, what are you doing? And they said, well, we don't like what we do. We hate this. And I thought, what are you talking about? I just assumed that everybody loved what they did the way I do. And because I truly do.
We'll talk about how you got there and what happened in those intervening 20 years or so and the years since, talking to William Travis Kukovich of William Travis Jewelry. How did he make it out of Southeast Kansas? How did he get to Chapel Hill? That's part of our conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Before William Travis Jewelry was featured in movies and on the pages of Vogue magazine, the man behind the jewelry lived a much less glamorous life. As a child, he often went without electricity during the summers because his mother just couldn't afford the bill. William Travis Kukovich eventually made his way to the Triangle, where he is making custom pieces and has been for decades, been running a jewelry store in Chapel Hill since 2002. Talked about being from that big family, and let's talk about your brothers, especially your brother Tim. Your brother Tim had autism, right?
My brother Tim has autism. It's pretty severe. It was tough. This is such a great community for autism. It's studied here at UNC, and there's so many resources here. But at that time, I didn't hear the word autism for a long time. It just people didn't know what it was, and you know, we were poor already, and then you have a brother with autism, which leads to a lot of fighting on the bus.
Because he's acting again. There's not a diagnosis. Nobody knows what it is. So it's just to the people on the bus strange.
Absolutely.
My
older brother Troy and I were always taking up for Tim, and my mother ordered it to be so. We were not allowed to not take up for Tim at all times, which we wanted to do anyway. It was really tough. Anyone who's grown up with a sibling with autism knows how hard it can be. But add it to poverty, it can really make for tough days in the community.
Yeah, and you were literally, I mean, getting into fights.
Oh, absolutely. We were literally fighting a lot for Tim. The first time it happened on the bus, I remember getting off the bus, and Tim was crying because some older boys at the back of the bus had asked Tim to go do something, and he did, and I think the girl slapped him, and my mother turned to us and said, if he's ever crying and you're not bleeding, we're going to have a problem.
Wow. There you go. So you went, and all this time, I mean, you're having your own problems in school, right? You can't read. Were you able
Absolutely.
To? Did you try to disguise that in school, or is that something?
I did. I wouldn't. when I would have to go to the remedial classes, I would walk down that hallway, and if any of my classmates were in the hall, I would just go in the bathroom until they got past, and I would sneak into the room. It's funny to think about now. Of course, they knew. But at that time, I somehow thought, and the teachers understood, I would be a little late or whatever, and they were always so gracious about it. They knew that it was embarrassing for me. You know, this was at a time when, you know, white Nikes with the red stripe for $50 was the big shoe, you know, and I was wearing Winner's Choice which said it on the tongue and with the, you know, the Walmart brand.
Yeah.
So hand-me-down clothes. My mother, we lived on a self-sufficient farm. When my grandfather passed away, my mother and her siblings inherited a small farm. And my mom just took us off the grid for about 6 years. And when I say off the grid, I mean off the grid. We did not have electricity during the summer. We had a shower that you would fill up with buckets of water and let it heat up at the top by the solar, and you know, get under it and dump water on yourself. We made all of our own. We farmed a lot of potatoes and put them in the cellar. We ate what we had, and we lived this way. Today, I'm very proud of that, but at the time, it was not cool at all. It's funny how those things have come around. I had homemade bread every day and whatever my mom would make. And I remember peeling the wax paper down just enough to get a bite so no one would see what I had there. You know, no one would what I was eating.
That it was homemade.
Yeah. I wanted Wonder Bread, you know.
And you're eating homegrown potatoes.
Oh, that's right.
And talk tomatoes about locally grown.
And we had bees and everything else. And now it's very hip and cool. But back then it was not hip and cool at all. I like to tease that I invented goat yoga. We had goats when we were a kid, and my brothers and I would go out in the pen and play with the goats, and they would climb all over us. And you know, we're talking about the 80s here. Yeah. And we have pictures of it. And now goat yoga is all popular.
I
invented that. I invented that. I can prove it.
But we don't know if the people in southern Kansas would have gone for it in the 1980s in the way that they're going for it here in North Carolina here in the 2000s. Talk about this. But these are a lot of barriers to continuing school. You were thinking of dropping out of high school.
Absolutely.
Your brother wasn't having any of
that. Absolutely. No. When I was 16, my brother and I are very close. My older brother Troy and I are very close. We decided that we needed to move out, and my brother moved out, and he did drop out of high school and for me and for us, and got a job and took care of me and let me continue to go to high school, and which, you know, led then to college and so on. But he really sacrificed a lot for me.
Talk about going to college now, because again, this is not anything that you can learn to do. You've had a head injury.
That's absolutely correct. And people are inherently kind, I believe. So they really wanted to help. You know, they could tell that I was trying, that I was working at it. You know, people want to help people who they see are trying to help themselves. So they were very generous. I would take these courses, and they would go to the professors and say, "Listen, just let him take his test orally. Don't grade him on spelling. Don't grade him on these things. Let us handle that portion in these remedial courses, and you just handle teaching him, because you can see that he's smart enough to do this, and you can see that he's trying." And that's what happened. And I can't thank him enough.
Well, talk about where you went to school as well.
I went to, the best metalsmithing jewelry technology school in the United States is located in Paris, Texas.
You were in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and Paris, Texas.
That's right.
So you got all over.
That's right. Texas Institute of Jewelry Technology. And I went there and got my associate's degrees there first, gemology and jewelry technology. And then I went to Stephen F. Austin University in Nacogdoches, Texas, where I got my geology degree. At that point, my dad had entered in my early 20s, my dad entered back into my life more as a mentor and a friend, and we get along very well now. But he really didn't want he really wanted me to go to college. He really wanted me to do that. So I did, and I what matched up best with my gemology training, what was the easiest degree for me to get, was geology. And I was also very interested in geology, and growing up in southeast Kansas, which is the beginning of the Ozark Mountain Range, where there's a lot of caves and spelunking, and the coal mining's going on there. So I was always interested in that anyway. And that's how I ended
those
up
Tom and Tom and Becky caves.
Oh, that's right.
Tom
yeah.
Sawyer and Becky.
That's right.
That's where they got all had their adventures. So now you're studying. You're making your way through school. How do you get to the Triangle, North Carolina?
I started winning some awards when I was design awards when I was very young, in 1920, and a large firm here. My last name, Kukovic, is kind of a well-known metalsmithing name, and they heard about me and invited me to come here, and this was already known all over. We're talking about the 90s now. It was already known pretty much all over the United States for sure that this was an up-and-coming place, the Research Triangle, and with high concentration of people with PhDs and four-year degrees and two income houses, and they wanted to set up a metalsmithing facility. So they gave me a shot. I was very young, and I came in and set up a seven-man shop and worked there for 10 years and really, really cut my teeth, learned a lot about the business end of my business, of my industry, which I did not know anything about. And again, I can't thank them enough for giving me a chance too. I think the theme of most people are good is important.
Well, so you learn that, and I'm wondering for you, you talked about metalsmithing in your family, but it was all kinds of work, candelabras and sconces and that sort of thing. When did you actually develop an interest in jewelry?
At about, I guess, 16, when my brother and I moved out to get jobs to support my mother. That's why we moved out, by the way. I'm not sure if I mentioned that earlier, but we needed to make money to help my mother take care of my siblings. So there was a little jewelry store there in Pittsburgh, Kansas, run by the Lavery brothers. They're still around that area, I believe. And they would let me come in on weekends and learn more. I was already casting and fabricating and doing lots of things with my family. I just needed to take it to a smaller scale. And by the time I was in, did my jewelry training, I was already, I could do just about anything. My professors had a debate over where to put me. Do we really start this guy out at the bottom? And they did. But there was a real debate of if I shouldn't just skip a lot of this and learn more.
How much did you quickly? But you did, so they decided to make you go through all the paces.
Mm-hmm.
Did that work to your advantage, or did you just lose time?
It absolutely worked to my advantage because I learned how to teach, because I became a teacher. I was as good as them, better than most of them, to be honest. I'm not trying to be in any way arrogant. I'm just so I learned to teach, and that was not born into me. You know, I had to learn how to speak to people and how to and at a young age, it's really hard to do, and especially with the chip on my shoulder. And I did have a chip on my shoulder from growing up so poor. You know, I think I've already said it. I have a chip on my shoulder.
So now you get to the Triangle. Talk about working there, because at a certain point, you said you worked there for, was it 10
years?
10 years.
10
and
years.
You thought, well, maybe it's time to be a partner here.
Time to be a partner there. And I did a very foolish thing. Don't ever do this. Have a job lined up before you ever before you ever do anything like this. But I got hot-headed about it one day and, kind of went to the owner and said, I believe I should be this. I've built this business. I've done this. And, if you can't give me this, then I don't know if I can work here anymore. And they said, well, I can see you're upset. Go home and think about it. And we'll talk later. And, I got a phone call that night thinking, this is all going to work out. And they said, remember when you said, if we couldn't give you this, that you didn't think you could work here anymore? Well, you can't work here anymore. So I was on my own in just a few hours. I went from having a 10-year career at this, and it was very scary. But growing up with this head injury and this disability taught me how to work, and of course, work ethic from my family. But obviously I have some skills and talent at this, but I outwork people. I mean, you just got to get in there and work. And that's what I did. And I worked out of my garage for 3 years. I would have clients find me and call me, hey, what are you doing? I'm over here in my garage, or I'm over here. And they would pull up. I didn't tell them where I was. And I'd push the button, garage door goes up, and they would say, what are you doing here? Like, oh, you know, I'm making jewelry just like I always was. Look, I got this over here. And many of them were very well-to-do and offered to support me, offered to give me no interest and low interest loans, and to help me. They already believed in me. And it's so nice to have people believe in you, right?
Tell us about the people who did, because getting the start, getting a stake to get yourself a proper space was not easy. You're in that catch-22, but you did find an angel.
Yeah, I did. I've never borrowed money in my life. I borrowed money for my home, but other than that, I've never borrowed money in my entire life. I don't use credit cards or anything like that. I think that that's a immigrant
thing. Say that again. You don't use credit cards even today?
Well, I do have one for the business, but I just pay it off every month because that's ease of it. But personal credit cards, I don't have. I've never borrowed money, which I think it's hard to build this business without borrowing money. But I'm glad I didn't. So when I started looking for a retail space, it was very difficult to get one. Getting retail space is like getting credit. You can't get it unless you already have it. So no one would give me a retail space. I would show them my awards and my designs. Wow, this is great, and I love this. Where's your current location? I'd say, well, it's in my garage. And they would say, oh, no. So I wanted to be on Franklin Street because at that time, Franklin Street was the most, and probably still is, probably the most well-known street in North Carolina. I mean, you can go to Asheville and say you're on Franklin Street. People know where you are. Mm. You can go to Charlotte. Everyone knows where Franklin Street is. So I wanted to be there, and University Square was there at that time, right there in front of Granville Towers. And the people managing it wouldn't give me the time of day. So I wrote a letter, a handwritten letter. I didn't write it. I had a friend write it and sign it to Mrs. Keenan, and she
of Keenan Flagler
of Keenan Flagler,
bad Mrs.
Yeah,
Keenan, yes.
That, yeah, and she and gave her my phone number, and she called me back, and she said, "I got your letter, and that was really nice. What is it that you want?" And I said, "Well, I'd really like to have a meeting with you. Could I please have a meeting with you?" And she said, "Yes." And you got to remember, I'm working out of my garage. This is so, you know, I will always love her for this. And I went to her office, and we sat there for probably a couple hours at least. And when it was all said and done, she stood up and she said, "Well, let's go pick you out a space." And all I could afford was a 700-square-foot space. So I didn't get financial deals or anything, but I got someone to give me a chance. So I built a little 700-square-foot store, and I'd been saving for 3 years, and you know, beans and rice, and saving every dime to build up all this jewelry, and I put it in to this 700-square-foot store, and within 6 months I was pretty much sold out. So we immediately started thinking about another space, and the Swenson space used to be there on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill became available. And I went back to them again and asked them if I could have that space. And again, they told me no. So again, I called Mrs. Keaton, and she
I need you to clarify this. I mean, it's a lease, right? It's like I can either pay this rent or
that's
not.
That's right.
So you can't, I mean, like sign the lease and
that's
pay
right.
the rent.
That's absolutely right. They told me that I wasn't ready. And that didn't set well with me. So I went to Mrs. Keenan and I told her. She said, well, what did they say? And I said, well, you know, they told me that I wasn't ready. And I'll never forget, she turned to me and she said, well, how would they know that? And I said, that's exactly what I said. That's exactly what I said. How would they know that?
You were ready.
So she said, well, as soon as you leave, I'm going to call them. And the next day they called me and said, come on up and you can get that space. And I was there for another 8 years in that space. I believe 8 years approximately in that space. And that's where my business really started to take off, because that was 1,200 square feet.
We will talk about how it took off and some of the high-flying clients and customers that you picked up along the way. And also your struggle with breast cancer. All of that is next on The State of Things as my conversation with William Travis Kukovich of William Travis Jewelry continues on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with jewelry designer William Travis Kukovich, who launched his first store in 2002 in the Triangle. And since then, he's been making jewelry for the stars. Let's talk about that. You met actor Orlando Bloom at a bar in Durham one night.
I did. My friend, I'll say his name, my friend Fergus Bradley has a little pub. And many of you may remember back in, I guess it's 96-ish, they were shooting a movie here in Durham before downtown Durham took off. I believe the movie was called The Streets, and it had Colin Firth and Orlando Bloom in it. And after Fergus had his wedding, and after the wedding, we decided to all go there. It was a very small wedding, maybe 15 of us, and it had been rented out to Colin Firth for the evening, and Fergus begged his way in. He said, sure, just your immediate party. And I went in there, and I had just opened up a little store in Costa Rica, William Travis, Costa Rica. It's on the Acoya Peninsula, Malpais, the Acoya Peninsula. And I was talking about this, and this woman behind me turns to me, oh, you have a place in Costa Rica? I just got back from Costa Rica. And I turned around, and it was this beautiful woman who turned out to be Orlando Bloom's girlfriend. And, gosh, I'm blanking on her name right now.
Well, it's okay. We get the idea. So now what happens?
So I start talking to her, and she said, oh, I told her, you know, that I have this little jewelry store there. She said, where? I said, in a little place called Flor Blanca. And she said, oh, I stayed there. I was shooting a Range Rover commercial, and I stayed there. She's a model. And she said, are you William Travis? I bought a piece of jewelry from – and I said, yes. She said, I bought a piece of jewelry from you. And I was just floored that this happened. So she ends up inviting me over, said, come meet my boyfriend, who ends up being Orlando Bloom. So I get up going over there, just hanging out with him, and we become, you know, friendly. And then I'm around the set quite a bit. And some of the guys from the set start talking to me, say, who are you? I said, oh, I'm a local jeweler. I have a place here. And they said, nah, I don't think so. You're hanging out with the celebrities. You know, there's got to be something else. I said, I don't know. This is what I do. So one of them in props came to my store. Said, do you change watch batteries? I said, of course. Yeah, I do it all. He said, I have a bunch of watches. So he brings all these prop watches over to get batteries changed in it. And at that time, he starts walking around the store, because it's going to take about an hour to change these 15, 20 watch batteries. And he walks around my store and he says, I really love your jewelry. And you're doing this kind of ancient oxidized silver 24 karat gold look. And when this movie's over, I'm going to Georgia, to Savannah, to Tybee Island off the coast of Savannah, Georgia, and to work on another movie with Miley Cyrus. And we need a line of jewelry. Would you be interested in doing a line of jewelry for it? And I said, of course, yes. So we did that. And that's sort of how I got into the celebrity business.
This, by the way, is a clip. We have a clip from the film. Maybe not a lot of people have seen it, but the jewelry is fabulous. Let's listen. Now, That's Miley Cyrus. You can't hear the pendant that she's wearing. She is a When I Look at You from the soundtrack of the movie The Last Song. This is pretty cool. You talked about the what's that like? I mean, to do this kind of thing. I mean, do you just sort of give it to them and they say yeah, yeah? Do they give you a lot of direction and what to make, what they're looking for?
They did give me some direction. They wanted throughout the movie she wore black Doc Marten boots, black pants, black hoodie with a hood up, and carried around a pink milkshake the entire movie. And she was an angst-ridden teenager and very goth. So that was the line that we did for them. And, you know, I had some help. Some friends who were in the industry helped talk me through that. They gave me good advice. They said, when you go down there to deliver this line, don't act like you're her biggest fan, because you're not. You know, find something in common with her. And I researched her a little bit and found that she started playing guitar at 12, and that's really when I started metalsmithing. So that's what I found in common with her.
Interesting. Yeah,
yeah.
You don't do the fanboy thing.
Absolutely.
Well, that's right. You mentioned the shop you had in Costa Rica. The way that came about, it's a pretty cool story.
It really is. All of this goes along with this philosophy that I developed of always saying yes. Of course, you can't always say yes, but I think the best way to put it is always say yes until you have to say no. And I had a client come in the store, a woman come in the store, love the Joyce. This is great. I've never seen anything like it. It's so unique. It's so different. I'm coming back with my husband. The next day on a Saturday, she came back with her husband, and he came in and he sat down at my design area, and he put his feet up on the desk immediately and got on his phone, and it really annoyed me that he would do that.
Yeah, he's not paying any attention.
Yeah, he's just on his phone the whole time. So she shopped all over the store, and she would bring things and show them to him, and he would just look away for a minute and nod yes, and she'd put it in a pile, and I helped her. And, you know, this went on for probably a couple of hours. And, you know, it was a lot of jewelry. It was a very, very large purchase, and one that we don't have purchases like that every day. But I just couldn't contain myself any longer. And as I'm writing it up, I couldn't help it. And I turned to him. It was the first time I'd seen a black card, by the way. He gave me a black card, and I knew what it was. So even with that in my hand, knowing what that meant, I couldn't stop myself. I said, "Hey,
no credit. Forgive me, but for those of us who don't know, this is the no limit credit.
Yeah,
you've got this in your hand.
Yeah, so I knew I was at risk of messing up one of the biggest sales that I was going to have that year, and I said, "Hey, listen, I see that you're not very interested in this, but you should know that this is custom made. This is all made by me, by hand, in house." This is not, you know, we're the farm to table of the jewelry industry. This is not Chili's, right? This is Nana's. And he put his phone in his lap and took his feet off my desk and swiveled his chair towards me, and he looked at me, and the only thing he said was, he said, "I have a place in Costa Rica. How would you like to design a line of jewelry for my place in Costa Rica?" That was his answer. And I said, I didn't say maybe, or we'll talk about it, or what would that look like. I said yes, and sure enough, he—that was it. He 2 weeks later, his secretary called me and flew my wife and I down to Costa Rica, and we took pictures of the fauna and flora and stayed in this beautiful 13 villa place. Called Flor Blanca, white flower, and that's how I got that deal. And, you know, that's what led to all these. This is that philosophy of saying yes to everybody that led to all of these great things happening in my life.
I just want to point out, though, that you've just undermined now twice some advice that you gave us earlier. So you're working for the shop in North Carolina. You've been there for 10 years, and you screw up the courage to say, "Look, either give me the partnership or I'm out." You preface that by saying, "Now, don't ever do this because of," and that is what led to this.
Actually,
bad advice. Go ahead and do that exactly. And when you feel a kind of energy about the the righteousness of your product, go ahead and say that. And it turns out that's the yes. So I just want to point that out.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Fabulous stories. And amazing, Julian, you do make the stuff in-house, right? You fire
We make everything in-house. Yeah. It's an amazing process. Everything is made from recycled gold from this community. We don't buy outside gold. We don't buy that. Everything is made. You come in, have one earring and a broken chain. This we purchase. We refine this down to 24 karat. We use our own alloys. We make our own everything. Of course, chains and bands are things that, you know, men's wedding bands that are silly to make, but and chains and these type of things. But 90% of our inventory is made by us in-house. Yeah. And it's a great process. We do tours on the weekends, mainly for kids, but adults love it. You know, it's big fire. It's teaching them this whole thing. And trying to pass this on, I feel like a lot of kids, I feel like we don't give our children enough choices. Yeah. We want to teach them that they can be a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or these. There's very limited choices. I doubt most of your audience was ever given the choice to be a metalsmith or a watchmaker.
It's a chance to practice an art in a way that you can actually make a living. Not that the other kind of art isn't worth pursuing, and certainly a lot of virtue. But if you are artistically inclined, it's nice to be able to think that you could sell a product as well.
That's correct.
We talked about your head injury. That's part of your medical history. You are also a breast cancer survivor.
I am. It was a crazy time in my life. But out of all of these turning points that we've been talking about, I feel like that was the big one. I was 26 years old, and I had some lumps in my chest. And for men, it's much easier to detect. They find it much earlier. And I was very lean at the time. And I went to my doctor here and showed him these. I wasn't really sure if they were anything, like a cyst, whatever. But he immediately said, "Yeah, we're going to get you to a specialist right away. It's Friday. We're having you at a specialist on Monday." And I went to a specialist here at Duke, and they said, "Yeah, we're going to remove these now. Like within a week, we're getting this out." And I was 26 years old. We all know we're going to die. It's inevitable death. But you think of it very differently when you're faced with it, when it's something that could really happen right now. And it's when I decided to, really throw caution to the wind and really go for it. And that is the year I got breast cancer and had it removed was the year I won my first Spectrum Award, which is the big one in our industry. And I contributed completely to that. It freed me. It gave me the will and the ability to want to make what I wanted to make when I wanted to make it. And it changed my life.
And your philosophy of saying yes, again, you went back on that when it came to chemotherapy. You said no to chemo.
I did. I don't know what was going on with me at that time. I think all survivors will. I think you have to be a survivor of it to understand it. But I didn't even tell anyone. I didn't tell my family that I had it. I told no one. I said no to chemo when I should have probably said yes. However, I'm clean now for 15 years, so I'm good to go.
Why did you? Why at that time? What was going through your mind?
I wish I could give you that answer. Maybe denial. I think denial of it. Or, I do.
Maybe saying it's not that bad.
Yeah, or or if I ignore it, it will go away, or something along those lines, or just it's get it over and move on. And I don't know.
You talked about not telling your family, but your mother did find out, right?
She did. They all did. I went back to Kansas 10 years later, and the local newspaper, you know, wanted to do an article on me. You know, a local boy makes good in the jewelry design world. And I showed up at a restaurant to meet the journalist, and she came in and she had a do-rag on and no eyebrows, and she said, "I'm sorry I'm late," and she said, "You know, I wasn't feeling very well this morning. I'm going through I have breast cancer and I'm going through treatment for that." And for 10 years I had not mentioned it to anyone, my friends, no one knew. And for some reason, in that moment, I just spilled it. And that is what the article ended up being about, it ended up being about surviving breast cancer, and not with a little bit of jewelry in there. But that's what it ended up being about. And I went to see my mother the next day, and she slapped me the moment I walked in the door.
What'd she say?
She cried and smacked me.
Yeah.
And
what'd you tell her about not telling?
I have to be honest here. I would love to give you a great answer for this, but I don't know why I didn't tell her. I don't know. Yeah. I don't have an answer for that. I wonder if any of our listeners who have survived this have had similar experiences where you just deny it afterwards, but it seems I couldn't tell you why. I don't know why. I think I just wanted to ignore it and maybe it would go away, make sure it was gone in that way. All my family was very upset with me.
Your father's a survivor.
My father just last year finished chemo. He got breast cancer 2 years ago and had it removed, and then went through a year of chemo. They've really refined that. It's not what it was when had it. It's not the heavy doses. They've refined that to lighter doses. And
Travis, great talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
William Travis Kukovich, designer behind William Travis Jewelry in Chapel Hill. Got some of our pieces posted on Instagram. You can also see some of it at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.